open the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue for Tuesday, March 27th, and we'll just go right through the agenda as it's listed. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 180. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 180 changes the definition of a financial organization. In current statute, the financial organizations are defined in two different places, one for taxation in general and one relating to apportionment, and there are slight differences in those definitions. Senate Bill 180 replaces those definitions with a definition taken from the Multi-State Tax Commission, and in order to have a unified definition of financial organizations. You also have in front of you a Dash 1 amendment, because as Senate Bill 180 as drafted, there was concern that the language actually brought in credit unions subject to taxation, which was not the intent. So the Dash 1 amendments do two things. They modify the language so that the credit unions are exempt, that they're not included in the tax, and it also limits the change to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2007. It does not allow the change for retroactively.
Thank you, Chris. Questions for Chris? Ms. Buchanan. There you are.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. I have provided a small packet of information for you. The first page on that is simply a summary of my testimony. The second page has the rule that the Multi-State Tax Commission adopted as a uniformity proposal. The other pages in the packet are those statutes that I thought might be relevant to the discussion this morning. So if I could just briefly say that this was intended to be a fairly simple proposal to ease the filing requirements for corporations. What happens now is that under Oregon law, if an affiliated group of corporations files a consolidated federal tax return, Oregon law requires that they file a consolidated Oregon return, and that's on page 3 of the handout. There is an exception for that if one of the corporations uses a different apportionment formula. And the way Oregon law works is general corporations such as merchandising or retail corporations use apportionment rules under the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act statutes, which are in Oregon law. So they use the general apportionment rules. Different apportionment rules apply for financial organizations. So going back again, if you have a consolidated federal return that includes several corporations, and then they come to Oregon, they have to consider whether or not they meet the definition of financial organizations for all of those to be in that consolidated return. So what has happened is over time business practices have changed, and what might have been a non-financial years ago now looks more like a financial. And banks also have ventured out into other business activities and may own, for example, mortgage banking corporations that under Oregon law don't meet the definition of financial organization. So what happens is you have this group of corporations that look like financials that are filing consolidated federal returns. When it comes to Oregon, there might be one or two of those that have to be peeled off and file separate tax returns because they don't meet the definition of financial under Oregon law. So what the bill was intended to do was simply provide an updated definition of financial organizations so that those corporations could be included on one consolidated return. And as staff mentioned, there is an amendment. When the bill was pre-session filed, we were contacted by representatives of the credit union industry. They were concerned that the language in there on page 2 of the bill, lines 1 and 2, could inadvertently subject the credit unions to tax. They are not now taxed on their credit union income. So an amendment was suggested to refer back to ORS 317.080, which you also have in the packet, and that is on page 4 of your packet. And subsection 1 of that statute says that organizations in 501C of the Internal Revenue Code are exempt from Oregon tax, and that is the reference that would include credit unions. So the thought was that by adding this reference back to 317.080, it would clearly provide that the treatment of credit unions is not changed by this bill.
What's the current language that we have regarding credit unions? It might be just buried right in here.
Credit unions, well, there is this general reference to IRC 501C. So that exempts credit unions, but then also on page 6 of the handout, there is a statute in ORS Chapter 723 that specifically, in my mind, lays out the treatment of credit unions to say that they are not subject to state tax. Mr. Chairman, after having the amendment prepared, I think there apparently were still concerns with the industry, and they have suggested that another amendment be prepared that would delete the language on page 2, lines 1 and 2 altogether, so that there would be no reference to credit unions in this statute. The department has no objection to that. The only effect of that would be that they would remain under current law, so that if they should be included in a consolidated return and then file for Oregon, they would need to be split out and use the regular apportionment factors. We don't expect that to happen very often, and it is something that we could administer if we wish to do that. Mr. Chairman, the only other thing I would point out on the amendments is that we were requested to make this prospective only and not have it apply to tax years before 2007. And we are fine with that. The reason that the bill was drafted as it is to apply to open years is that some companies have actually filed in a manner that would match the bill. So, in other words, they have not separated out their non-financials and filed separate returns for them. So the bill as it was originally drafted would have validated those return filings. I don't expect that we would make a big project of going back and adjusting those. So if they did come up in audit, we would simply tell them the law for those years means that you need to file a separate return and expect that they would do that.
Who made that request?
Mr. Martinez with the, I believe, the Oregon Bankers Association, if I have that correct.
Who was in St. Louis this weekend? Mr. Martinez, did he do it via email? Just my own personal questions.
That is all, Mr. Chair. Happy to try to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. Questions for Ms. Buchanan? Thank you very much. So we're waiting for a couple amendments, and are you having them drafted? Or
I was not, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so whoever is... Okay. Heads are nodding. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 180. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 816. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
What does Senate Bill 816 do?
Senate Bill 816 is very similar to Senate Bill 653, which was passed out yesterday for the floor. The difference is that this one permits tax-exempt entities to claim exemption for property held under sublease from an exempt owner. And under current law, any leases or lease purchases by an exempt religious organization, for example, would be exempt. But in a situation where they sublease from an exempt owner, under current law, they have to pay a penalty. The previous testimony on that related bill, Senate Bill 653, that required exempt entities to pay tax if they subleased from taxable owners had some testimony that said there was about, they paid about $257,000 in 1 year in taxes. I've taken that number and basically factored it up for the state and divided it by two in order to show that half of, perhaps for simplicity, that half of the denials for the exemption pertain to subleased properties from exempt owners versus taxable owners.
Questions for Mary? Wondering if we could get these combined into one bill as they move over to the House. The ones we had yesterday are similar, and I'll call up Brian Beringer and Mary Kennedy. That might be an opportunity to get two or three bills wrapped into one. Morning, OHSU.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Beringer with Oregon Health and Science University. I'm mostly here to introduce Mary, who will give just a couple quick examples of where this exemption would prove useful. And this is basically because of an adverse court case that has just come down where it's sort of changed how this has worked. But I just wanted to add two things real quick. We did get a phone call yesterday from an outside law firm that was asking for a retroactivity clause to the current tax year. That's up to the committee whether or not they want to deal with that or have it dealt with on the other side of the building, but we would support that. And then I guess the other thing I would say is that we would be okay, definitely, if you want to roll those two bills together. That's up to the committee and your staff. Mary?
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Mary Kennedy. I'm the lease administrator at OHSU, director of what we call space planning and management. And so I deal with our various leases. And in the past, it really hasn't made much difference whether we're leasing or subleasing property. But with this tax decision, it has changed things in the world of subleasing. So I want to give just a couple of examples. We have programs out in various neighborhoods that are in lease space. One of them is part of the Department of Psychiatry. It's called the Children's Day Treatment Center. And it's been in lease space for many years, and they wanted to sublease some of their space to another nonprofit organization, the Morrison Center, and they had a lot of things that they did with the same population. But as they were working toward doing that, the Morrison Center realized they would now have to pay property tax if they were a sub-lessee rather than a lessee, and so they decided to look for space elsewhere. And it would have worked really well to have those two programs together. And again, this is something recent that we've been dealing with that we haven't had to deal with in the past. We also have had a couple of clinics out in, I'll mention the Tiger Clinic. We decided to close it down, but we wanted to sublease space to other nonprofit entities. So we had part of Washington County's WIC program in there, and we had a legacy clinic in there, both of which would be tax exempt. When this changed, they then were looking at paying property tax, and so legacy came to us, and there was a lot of negotiation with the landlord. It worked out because the landlord could look at legacy as being a good tenant, as OHSU had been, but we were able to turn legacy into the lessee, step away from it. Washington County still has the same problem. They're a sub-lessee now, but with legacy instead of OHSU. So anyway, the upshot is we're having to make decisions about where we're putting people based on not so much the location, not so much neighbors, not so much our clientele, but in sublease situations, we are avoiding particular properties because of this new wrinkle.
Mr. Chair, I just add one thing too. As far as the revenue impact goes, for larger nonprofits, I'm sure the formula actually holds. But for some of these smaller nonprofits, this additional tax liability is enough. And mm-hmm. We provide a few examples on your testimony that these entities are just finding it easier to create their own lease and separate property than assume that liability. So there's a little bit of liability avoidance that's going to go on now in the current situation. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions for this panel. OHSU Senator just Ann Tigerts just entered and made herself coffee.
It took a long time, Mr.
That was
Chair,
a long cup of coffee.
The machine is really slow.
We'll
but
fix
I listened
that.
Carefully all the time I was doing it.
Questions for this panel. I'm sure folks from yesterday know the answer to this. Is this because we had two cases yesterday. This is one that's similar to that. Is it because, and John, you could probably weigh in too, just because of one court case? John Phillips from the department who handles property tax issues.
Hi, Mr. Chair. John Phillips of the Department of Revenue, members of the committee. Not sure about the court case. I think you're talking about the Erickson case, possibly.
We've been relying on our attorney who's been checking the Department of Revenue, so I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, I think our interpretation of the statute's been constant. I think some of the counties have been administering it a little bit differently, so it may appear to a taxpayer as a change in policy. So maybe when this opinion came down, and I've been told that there's a case called the Erickson case that confirmed our interpretation. So that might be the genesis of that question. The two bills in our view are very, very similar, almost precisely the same thing. We would prefer, though, after having talked about them a little bit more and thought about them, that they some of the aspects of both be combined. It does make sense. And the real administrative issue for us that we see is the link between adding sublessees and the requirements that the entity requesting the exemption fulfill. And so, at the very last section on, let's say, line subsection 5 of page 2 of the bill, it talks about the sublessee being exempt, and then the final line says, if all the requirements of the section are otherwise met. But when you go back and read the other subsections, it's requiring the lessee to do this or the lessee to do that. And so it's who's meeting the requirements question. When the person goes in to apply, they may be a sublessee and they would qualify, but the question is whose responsibility is to meet the requirements. So I think if we had both of the bills combined, and I've been talking and having conversations with Sandy from NETCO, the other entity that which I don't even know the acronym means, but she represents the other bill, the 653, and she's very open and amenable to making it work.
Is this Senator Morse's bill?
I believe it was.
From yesterday.
Yes. No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator no. Walker.
Paul's Senator giving the...
Senator Walker.
The you're safe signal.
Paul knows everything. So we'd be happy to work with...
Yeah, who Senator George, would you like to at least monitor and so that... if we're going to move bills out, and then I guess the retroactivity question, this is just based on a phone call, so I don't know if that law firm ought to in some way engage themselves, but do you see a problem with a retroactivity clause on Senate Bill 816? I know that probably just learned of it 10 minutes ago.
Right. My suspicion would be that there's probably not a lot of these, and I can imagine that it could be done. It's a county function, mm-hmm. but we'd be happy to work with counties in getting that done.
Yes. That was my next, just ask the counties who are here. Other questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Murrow.
Do you want to reconsider the bill, the vote by which we moved the bill out yesterday, so that you can bring it back and merge the two of them together?
What do you guys think? I mean, we could either do that or just let them go over
we
to the House.
Send them both and send a note to the House Chair that you think these could easily be merged together.
Yeah, that's the great thing of having Paul and Mary who work with the House at 1 p.m. Because it just seems to me this is a great opportunity, and that's why I was looking to Senator George.
And Senate bills, it's a good idea to get Senate bills moving as fast as possible because we're running out of time.
Uh-huh. So does that sound good to folks? We'll send these along. The retroactivity one is the only one that I'd ask that at least someone take a look at.
Retroactive.
And OHSU can let us know, or at least let that law firm know that it must have a case or two that they'd like to see retroactively administered. Thank you. Thank you. Gail, do you want to chime in or just involve yourself, maybe through Senator George's office, who hasn't yet nodded to me, but...
I'm okay. I'm just... Very quickly, Mr. Chair. Gil Riddell, Policy Manager, Association of Oregon Counties. The immediate issue that arises with retroactivity is the refund, having to take money that's already obligated and repay it. So if this is a small sum, then, you know, we could talk, but I just caution that that would be an issue.
Right. That's a good point. So why don't, Senator George, is that okay? We'll just we'll send these bills along, and then if we're going to work a little group with Mr. Phillips, Mr. Riddell, whoever from Senator Morris's office that has the other bill, and then call our mayor as we send these over.
I believe it was Senator Walker had the other bill.
Oh, Walker.
Morris's bill was a different one.
That was the assessor's one.
It was the one where if you tear down a building, you reassess the value of the property kind of thing.
That's right. That's right. Okay, well, we'll finish up with this. Any other questions that folks have on Senate Bill 816? Or
you want to move it then?
I do. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 816. Open a work session on Senate Bill 816. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I would recommend that Senate Bill 816 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 816 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections to that motion? So ordered.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator George assigned me to carry the companion bill, so I'd be happy to carry this one as well since they kind of go together.
Great. Okay, so Senator Morrell, and you'll make some sort of notation that we're trying to
In the House, we may merge these two together.
And we'll try to get them, if we can, coupled together on the floor so that anyone who's keeping score of all of these can easily follow the issue and what we're doing. Okay, so Senator Monroe will carry Senate Bill 816. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 623.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Monroe,
I would like to testify on this bill and introduce this chief sponsor.
Okay, good.
He's a long-time friend of mine.
Long-time friend, maybe constituent.
Not a constituent.
He's
a long-time friend.
Long-time friend. So we'll invite up Mr. LaFont, and Senator Rod Monroe will introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rod Monroe, Senate District 24. This bill has to do with the status of a parsonage. And churches historically used to all have parsonages, so that when they called a minister to be the pastor of that church, his housing would be provided in a house. Usually located near the church. A lot of churches nowadays have gotten away from that, but Richmond Community Church still has a parsonage. Richmond Community Church in close-in southeast Portland is where I grew up. That was my home church when I was a small lad growing up. And in fact, my father was helped build the parsonage that is still there. Richmond Community Church currently does not have a pastor. The pastor just resigned and went to another Texas, I think, and they are in the pulpit committee search mode trying to find a new pastor while they are renovating and cleaning up the old parsonage, now old, about 40 years old, I guess, or more, maybe 50 years old. I don't know. Yeah, we're all getting older. Anyway, I remember when it was
went
built.
Went from 40 to 50. Yeah, I'm pretty quick
50 years or so. Anyway, and the county has been kind of uncertain as to the status of a parsonage, whether it should be
tax exempt as other church property is. A parsonage is a home that is used exclusively for the pastor of that church. The pastor might also have some Bible study in his home, or possibly even, if they're tight for space, a Sunday school class might be taught in that home. But it's exclusively for church use, and I believe, to be consistent, ought to be tax exempt. And this bill simply clarifies that a parsonage, when used as a parsonage, is tax exempt. Now, if Richmond Community Church hires a new pastor and the new pastor doesn't choose to live in the parsonage, and Richmond Community Church then chooses to rent out the parsonage, then it becomes taxable and ought to be taxable. That's basically the nature of this bill. Don LaFont and I have known each other since college days, maybe before. Our parents were good friends, and so we go back a long ways. And it's my pleasure to introduce Mr. LaFont, and I'll leave here and let you take over. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator McGrath.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Don LaFont, and I'm here. This was actually heard, I think, under a different bill back in 2003, if Mr. Senator Deckert remembers. I was here then also. And the first six pages of this that you have in front of you is just to show that there has been established communication between myself and both the tax exemption specialists in Multnomah County, as well as some communication here recently with the Department of Revenue here in Salem. If you'll excuse the dates on these letters, my computer is such that when I pull it up to look at it, it puts today's date on. If I looked at it today, it would say 2007. And so I just changed the year because I didn't remember the exact date that these letters were sent out. So I put back 2005 because I know it was at least that far back that I had communication. The first time I was when our former pastor, Pastor Bolton, and his family came to Portland in 1996, our church filed for exemption in 97, and I've been involved with the Multnomah County tax exemption specialist since 99, going every year, and Mr. Skinner would always, well, here you are again. We'll turn it down again, and so I kept communicating with him. I said, well, what do we really need to do to get this exempt? And he told me, he said, well, you have to take us to court or you can go through the legislature. Well, I went through both avenues. I went through court, and it was turned down because I failed to point out some of the things that I realized after the court date. But I also then... That's why it came in 2003, was at his suggestion that it be brought to clarify language. What I realized later was that in page number 7, you'll see has Oregon revised statutes as they currently stand on 307.140 and 307.162 is on 7 and 8, and it's included only because it is mentioned in the above ORS. Then what I got to looking at, though, was they were quoting the OAR 150, which I understood later was what the Department of Revenue drafted from the ORS to clarify it for their people. And when I got down to 150-307.140, with parentheses around number 4, what I got to finding out was what they were doing when they read it. They would read number 1, and they would get down here on the second sentence, which says a parsonage or caretaker's residence is totally taxable. They would put a period there, and they wouldn't go on to read unless it meets the criteria established in 140. And it's my belief that we do meet the criteria in 140 because it's, number 1, owned by the religious organization, the church. Number 2, It's necessary because, like I say, everybody needs a place to live, and as our pastor, our spiritual leader, they also need a place to live. And the definition, which was part of my thing, I wanted to clarify that with the Department of Revenue to find out if we were talking on the same page, and they said yes, a parsonage is a residence provided by the church for its spiritual leader, its church, its pastor, its cleric, whatever term you want to use. And so, but they were going and applying business use to a personal residence to the parsonage. The parsonage is a church-owned building, not a personal building, not a personal residence. And they were applying that, so therefore they were denying the exemption, saying that, well, what was it used for? It's for them to live, right? And I said, yes. But they're there living there because they are the leader of the church. They're the pastor of the church. And so then in the C part, the actual use of the property meets with the need. And what is the need for one? Well, like I said, it's multifold. It's, first of all, of our last four pastors that we've had, we had a interim pastor for 1 year who lived in Portland area. But the others have all come to us from California, from out of state. So we had a place for them to come to and get involved in the church rather than looking for a place to buy, looking for a place to sell when they resign. And so it is owned by the church. And we provide this for them. Also, another part that I think is important about a parsonage is a pastor's job is not a 40-hour week. It's not 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. And if you come to me because you work 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, you come to me at 6 o'clock if I'm the pastor, which I'm not. But if I were a pastor and you came to me, I'd say, you know, come back to me at 9 o'clock on Monday morning. Well, I can't. The need is now.
Yeah.
I can't come back Monday morning. I've got to be at work. So the availability of the pastor to meet the individual needs of the congregants there, I find is very important. And in our case, anyway, it's in the in the community that we serve. It's the community that the church serves. It's where the location of the parsonage is. And that is not necessarily... The difference was, in the court case, that why they threw it out was because we had a pastor that lived there, and he was getting up in years, and he was going to retire, wanted to retire in the Portland area, so he wanted to buy his own residence. And it was 9 miles away. If a person comes for help to the church, and they can't find the pastor at the church building, he's not in the church office, because 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night. Yeah, they take off and drive this 9 miles out to his house. He may have thought of something he forgot to do. He may be coming back in a different route, and you never get together. So being located close to the church in the community that the church serves, I find very another part that's important to this. And I think that's all I have for right now.
Thank you. Yes, Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I couldn't agree with you more, because anybody I've ever known that was in the ministry will tell you that you are available to that flock 24 hours a day, because many times you have conflicts and you have people that have special needs. There may be somebody that's not even a member of your church who's there to seek help. And it's always bothered me that we've moved away from this. And today, another thing that I think is important is because there's been so much vandalism against churches nationwide, that to have somebody nearby the building is basically just kind of keeping an eye on things for security and protection. So you have the security and protection of the flock, and you have the security and protection of the building. So, I mean, to me, this is part of the function of the church. And, because that person has dedicated his life to that ministry. And obviously, many times, these people are not paid at what we would consider to be an acceptable wage for a person packing a doctorate many times. And so, therefore, this is a way for the church to be able to help them to survive, providing that service, you know, on 24-hour day service, you know, to the people in the community. So I think it is a community interest that we tax exempt. Other than that, you probably know where I'm going to vote.
Strong voices. So questions or other comments for Mr. LaFont? Do we know how many parsonages there are in Oregon?
No, I don't. I didn't. I just got involved with ours with the state in Multnomah County.
I know it's getting scarce. There are fewer and fewer churches that have parsonages, but those that do, it really does serve it. This parsonage is right across the street from the church, and it's an ideal location. And I don't think the revenue impact on the counties is going to be significant of this, because most churches have gotten away from having a parsonage. But for those that do, I think it's a religious use. When a pastor does not choose to live in a parsonage, or when a church has no parsonage and the pastor is buying a house or renting a house, the money that goes toward his housing is tax exempt. They pay no income tax, either federal or state, on that amount, the housing allowance amount of their salary. And so it's, I think, just as appropriate to have a parsonage that is resided in by the pastor, and only if it's resided in by the pastor, to be tax exempt.
Thank you.
The only other thing I was going to say was on page 10 was what I submitted originally to Senator Brown's office, and then that's where the Legislative Council came up with the wording they did in Senate Bill 623, Section 1, Item 2. Which, as Senator Monroe has said, puts the house back on the tax roll if it's rented or used for anything other than housing the pastor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gail Riddell, John Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to participate in a press conference downstairs on secure rural schools and a tour that's going to take place to southwestern counties. So I prefer to go first, if that's all right with you.
You were on your way,
okay.
Yes.
Okay,
sir.
Very quickly. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties Policy Manager. We see this as particularly narrow, but it gives me an opportunity to provide our standard caution about new property tax expenditures, so I'm going to take that opportunity and just take a moment. Remember, we're now in a rate-based system, rate-based cut and cap property tax system, so any new property tax expenditures translate into lost revenue for essential public services. We already have a volume of tax expenditures that you see every biennium. So we ask that any new requests, that you set the bar high in terms of the need, and also that the exemption relates directly to that need. So I believe you should inquire, what is the capacity of the church to do this themselves? That would be a typical question I think I would suggest that you ask. Be mindful, too, that you have stated in a series of statutes beginning at ORS 306-350 that the legislature's intention is to pay for new property tax expenditures. So that is paid out of a fund that has never been stocked with any revenue, but it does provide an intention statement of you that you're mindful that this is a direct loss of local revenues. The state, of course, uses income tax primarily for their services. So with that, that'll be the end of my remarks.
And do you have a position on this bill, or still looking at it?
I'm curious about the extent of the exemption, and the case, frankly, is attractive for it, but I would like to know the capacity of the church to do this themselves. That would be a question, just a standard question I'd ask in the process.
Mr. Chair.
Senator
Burke. Where is that located, where it says the...
Yes, ORS 306-350 at SEC for lawyers. There's a series there. It was passed in 1999. And we've not been successful at gaining revenue appropriations to this fund, but it does state the intention that 50%, the cost to local governments of a new property tax expenditure would be paid for, 50% of that would be paid for.
So, Mr. Chair, to follow up, would one way of doing that be to go into the statutes and find another exemption and repeal it?
Excellent point, Mr. Chair. Senator Burdick, that is one of the means to adjust this, indeed. It's stated in that series.
There are property tax exemptions that have been talked about a great deal, especially in the special sessions, that if we wanted to offset all of the revenue impact on this one, it's going to be, I would think, pretty minimal. But good segue to John Phillips.
Thank you, Mr.
Thanks.
Chair, if I may.
Yes, please. Thank you. Go to the press conference.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. We don't take a position on this bill. There are a couple of administrative issues that I had a chat with Mr. LaFont yesterday and shared with Senator Monroe this morning. And they just deal around the issues of some of the technical things that have created the situation in the first place. And we do have a case. The German Apostolic Christian Church went to the Supreme Court over this issue years ago. And our rule basically parrots the two criteria that the court set, and that was the primary purpose of the facility be for the purpose of the religious organization, and the court found that the primary purpose of the residence was a residence, and so that was one of the reasons. And so this bill would clarify that the residence, you know, is of itself the purpose for which the exemption could exist. So that would help greatly. There's some words like in line 7 where it says used solely for. If it was used solely for the residence, that would help us understand that, you know, the parsonage is used solely for that. It's owned by the religious organization, which the bill doesn't talk about who owns the building. So just a couple of things I shared with Senator Morris Monroe this morning on those issues, but that's why the rule says what it does. It's words from the court interpreting your statute. So I hope that's helpful, and we just want to be sure that if you pass the bill that we can, you know, decide who really does qualify and who you intended not to qualify. So
Do you know offhand how other states treat parsonages?
Mr. Chair, I do not. Haven't looked into this in great depth.
Fair. And Mr. LaFont, I don't know if you've been more active on this issue. You can nod if
I know several do.
If you're nodding, we can get, but more than nodding, we can't.
I know several
Don LaFont.
Do when I
say your name again.
Excuse me. My name is Don LaFont. Mr. Chairman, I looked into this a little bit, and I didn't get through all 50 states, but several of them do have exemptions for parsonages. And just earlier this year, I was up talking to Representative Rosenbaum's office, and one of her assistants there said that that Missouri, I know, is one that does. He said that his grandparents lived there, and their church did not have a pastor. They gave a built home to the church to have as a parsonage. It was declared a parsonage and became tax exempt. So that they, and shortly thereafter, they got the pastor that they had been missing for several months.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Monroe.
I'd like to have an amendment drafted that would clarify that the church own the building.
Yes.
That's not clear in here. And then I'd like to have the bill brought back for work session.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, and that's sorry.
Isn't that clarified in line 5 of the bill? It says the following property owned or being purchased by the religious organization shall be exempt from taxation.
Okay.
Seems clear to me.
So, Simmero, if you could get together with John, and I mean, that was John. And
I think it's clear.
I'd like to take a look at it, but I'd be happy to work with you on it.
Okay. If you need an amendment to clarify that, I'd be happy to sponsor it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Great. Senator Burdick.
I'd like to see a revenue impact on this, and if it's anything more than de minimis, I'd like to look at some other exemptions we could put in this bill to repeal to pay for it.
And we are, in general, holding off on credits and expenditures. And actually, next week, we're going to start looking at income tax credits. And this one, obviously, is small property tax. But we have, as you probably noticed, have been holding off on all the expenditure side. We've got a few house bills that are now over here coming here. And so we'll look at them all in context and not pass them out one at a time, because we'll ring up the bill, and that'd be a great time to bring amendments in terms of property tax or income tax credits to take off the books.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe, and then George.
The issue came up as to the ability of the church to do otherwise. This is a very small church, maybe 100.
Yes.
Size congregation, and it is a very modest house.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're not talking about a big mega church here.
But, Mr. Chair, this bill would apply to all churches, not
that
just
have parsonages.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just, as we're looking at this whole issue of the fairness and the legitimacy of the tax exemption, I would like everybody to think about the fact that OHSU was just here talking about their tax exemption for a place of psychiatry. Well, I'm going to tell you that many times that problem is going to be solved by a minister probably from his home. And so I think it is comparable, it's comparable to recognize that that is the kind of thing that is being provided by the work of the church. I mean, I'll bring my Bible next time if I have to show you that that is the work of the church. So, but I would just ask everyone to remember what we're looking at is the reason for tax exemptions mainly was, are they providing a public service? The answer on this bill is yes, it does, in my opinion.
And does it have, this is the question, inside the parsonage, is that, because obviously inside the church, and that's a really good point, that we just considered what OHSU and other nonprofits, and I think it's your testimony, Mr. LaFont, that yes, it also happens within the parsonage. That type of work is not your typical 9-to-5
right.
Vocation.
It's kind of like being a senator.
That's
yes. Maybe we can get our parsonages as tax exempt. There's a good amendment. other questions for the panel? Thank you very much. Thank you, John. Mr. LaFont, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 623, and we are adjourned until tomorrow at 8:45. Thank you.